morning, wake up, wake. Good morning, wake up, wake. Good morning, wake up, wake. All right, well, thank you for coming, everyone. This is what we're calling Live at CDA, and really grateful for everyone who can come out, and I'm really excited to do this, for sure. I met Ed Tarbuck here about a year ago, and my life has not been the same ever since. Ed's a character that needs no introduction at some level, and obviously you see the signs around the state, you see the advertisements, and then I met him, and it was just like, what an engaging personality and a fun guy and an authentic person and somebody who's like really intense and really fun-loving, and look forward to every time I got to interact with him. So I'm excited to find out more about Ed, how he does it, how he's done it, where, how he got to this point, what he does differently than the rest of us to fit all this stuff into the same 24 hours that we have, and learn a little bit. So I'm excited to learn a little bit more about the backstory for Ed. So thank you so much for
Thanks for having me, Spencer.
Yeah, yeah. So the Tarbuck business has been around for years. Tell us more about like where it started, how you got here.
First, let me say, I was thinking on the ride over that this is a win-win for me. Either I can bomb and not entertain at all, or the other win would be I do bomb and Spencer here has egg on his face, so that's I can't lose. I'm the third generation Tarbox in the car business. We got to go in the Wayback Machine to the 20s when my grandpa started. He was an early gas station. He'd pump gas and service cars, and grandma ran a roadside stand, and this was out in front of their home. Grandma was the character of the operation because she learned the trick of running that roadside stand. It's where the local townsfolk knew where to get their bottle. This is during Prohibition. So that is the advent of our business. So Grandpa early on learned that you know, fixing up an old jalopy and selling it was more profitable than pumping gas. So soon thereafter, they decided to expand business and move away from the home and built an ash block building on a busier street. And sales were good and business was good. And it wasn't long before a manufacturer came to him and asked him to represent their product. And this is Chrysler. So he was the first of the Tarbox to have a car dealership. The franchise was taken away from him because this was World War II, and the Chrysler production facility was converted to producing tanks for the war. You can imagine that during that period, when there were no parts availability and raw materials were hard to come by, the guy that could keep your car together was a popular guy. So after the war, another franchise had approached him. Back then, business was really brisk, and there were a lot of people entering and exiting that business, so there were a lot of transactions taking place. But he started with a company called Kaiser Frazier, which later turned into Hudson. This is probably in the 50s, and Grandpa had some ill health. I actually never got a chance to meet my grandpa. He passed away before I was born. But his ill health forced my father to leave the University of Rhode Island. He joined the family's business, and it wasn't long before Nash became Rambler, and Rambler merged a former company called American Motors, and they had asked him to, if you're going to represent our product, you need to build a new building. So he bought the adjacent property from Grandpa's shop. Grandpa's shop converted into a body shop that still today is Mike's Auto Body. Some of you might know Mike's Auto Body over on the other side of the on the other side of the bridge. He built his American Motors, and they acquired a company called Willys, which was Jeep. So he became a Jeep dealer, and he went out and purchased another franchise called Pontiac, which was the youth sport brand of the day. Business was good for Dad for a few years, but he had his share of hardships, probably a little bit more than a decade. What had happened is the government closed Quonset Point. Probably two-thirds of his business was written off the schedule. So you can imagine suffering through that. And soon a follow-up punch to that was high inflation, and interest rates were climbing, and the gas crisis. He had his share of difficulties. I got involved in the business in the late 70s. I loved hanging out at the shop, especially that body shop. Mom would drop me off, and I'd hang out with Dad, and I worked with him on Saturdays cleaning cars. So that's my introduction to the car business. I graduated Bishop Henriken and then went to school at Stonehill College, which is near Brockton. My brother, who was born with a congenital heart disease, he didn't make it through open heart surgery, and he passed away. And my dad, that was the straw that broke the camel's back. Dad was completely demoralized and was going to sell the business. I let him know that I had an interest in the business. I knew I wasn't going to be a professional athlete, or I wasn't going to be an astronaut. I wasn't good in math and science, and I had no athletic ability. So I mentioned to Dad that I'd like to get involved in the business, but he didn't want me to follow suit with him and quit college. But I managed to transfer to URI. I stacked my classes in the morning. I was able to work in the afternoons and Saturdays, and you know, those were the busy times to be for retail business anyways. Kind of like everything in my life, I liken myself to Forrest Gump. Business got good there. We came out of the economic downturn. Jeep got popular. So when I graduated from college, I was probably the youngest general manager, and Dad was re-energized. He had a son that he felt had some ability, and he was re-energized in the business, and we were off to the races. Soon thereafter, somebody knows my brother Jim. My brother Jim got involved in the business, and we realized how small that little nest egg was, and the plan was going to be that we were going to buy some additional dealers and dealerships and expand. But I had some misgivings about a family business and the some of the idiosyncrasies that come with family business. And I liken it to the first partnership that I had with Jim. We went 50-50 on a toboggan. So it was, I used it going uphill, he used it going downhill. So that kind of cured me on partnerships. So I had a relationship with a guy from over here, from Newport, Richard Godoyan. I don't know if any of you remember his name. He was like me, took over for his father's business. He had on this road here a bunch of dealerships. And he had when the economy was bad, he made a move over at Inskip and bought Inskip. So he was a really young guy and had these two big outfits. And he had a little Toyota store in North Kingstown that didn't fit into his portfolio. So him and I got together over a cup of coffee, talked about what it would take to transfer that business to me. And with sponsorship from Dad, it was off to the races. I had my first dealership at a very young age. Business was really good. Again, Forrest Gump in it. Toyota got popular. And the difference between me and Rick is he was an absentee owner at that place and maybe had the wrong management in there. Probably the first month in, we sold 120 cars, and he had been selling 25, 30 cars a month. So we bought the property to the north and to the south of us, expanded that building and improved it for Toyota, and business was really good for us. So we were in a state that's 40 miles northeast, southwest. We were the number one dealer in the state of Rhode Island, and probably, you know, there's 8 Toyota dealers in the state of Rhode Island, and that marketplace in North Kingstown is what we call a primary market area. Is actually pretty small, kind of like Newport here or like Westerly. Those are also marketplaces that have Toyota representation. But we, by far, got the lion's share of the business. The second and the third place dealership, you could add them up, and they still didn't equal what we were selling. So the Hyundai store, how I got the Hyundai store was kind of out of necessity. What was going on with Toyota then, the vehicles were real popular, and we would get the lion's share of the allocated cars to the Rhode Island market. The only thing that would interrupt that turn and earn or sales to availability formula was if you were building a new facility for the manufacturer. And it just so happened that there were 3 dealers that were doing that in the marketplace. It was over here in Newport, was moving from, I guess, what is this, West Main Road to East Main Road. He was doing his facility enhancement. Colonial Toyota moved from Pawtucket out to Route 295 in Smithfield. And most importantly, my competitor in Warwick, Norwood Toyota Chevrolet, he sold out to Belize, and Belize was building a new dealership. So they all at the same time were getting the inventory off the top of the available inventory to seed their business. And it meant that, you know, the prior year had sold 37 Camrys in August. I mean, that was our number one selling car. And we came into the summer selling season with 3 vehicles. So we were forced to get real good at service, which, you know, you always try to find the silver lining in the thing. We were forced to get good at service, and we ended up selling 2-to-1 used cars to new cars. But we also made a play at a local Hyundai store on Route 2. So you can imagine, as a kid, Route 2 was the big leagues. That's where you wanted to be if you wanted to be in the car business. So I bought this guy's Hyundai store. And again, here comes Forrest Gump. It turned into a real opportunity for us. It ended up being not only, soon it was the number one Hyundai dealer in the state, but it's been ever since, without looking back, the number one Hyundai dealership in New England. The Hyundai in a typical market sells 3 or 4% market share, 4% in a real well dealered and well represented marketplace. We were running Hyundai at 9%. I mentioned Toyota because don't you think Toyota suddenly woke up and paid attention? They're like, we're not at 20% market share anymore. What's going on? Who's this Hyundai dealer? Well, it's your dealer too. It's Tarbox. So they had the epiphany, got us the vehicles, and soon we were back to being number one Toyota dealer and number one Hyundai dealer in New England. So fast forward to where we're at now. That's a little bit of a story too. We had outgrown Toyota in its facility in North Kingston on Post Road. Equally, what was happening is the town no longer wanted North Kingstown to be a four-lane road. It was going to be turned down to a two-lane road, a median put in the middle. So the writing was on the wall that it was going to be difficult for us to attract that larger geographic area at that location. So we endeavored to find some property that my needs, I felt if we were going to invest that kind of money, was highway access and highway visibility. So I found a piece of property that I thought was going to work, but the Toyota dealers to the north of me, they pulled their resources to oppose me at Rhode Island Dealers License Commission. You had to, if you were within 10 miles with any competing dealer, you can't not infringe on their territory. Well, this property that I located was not, if you calculate by the way the crow flies, but they prevailed in preventing me from moving there because their argument was drive time was closer than your current location. So how am I going to win that? I mean, that's the whole plan. You want to move to a highway access. So I wasn't able to move, but it didn't discourage us. We ended up finding the 18 acres where we're at now. It had that highway access and visibility, probably better than the other location. But this time I was a little bit smarter. I went to Toyota and said, hey, listen, you're going to need to cajole these other guys to allow me to do this relocate. And that's exactly what happened. So we were able to relocate the Toyota store. And that was 7 years ago. And then just more recently, 3 years ago, we relocated a Hyundai from Route 2 to that location as well. Had a little bit of difficulty doing that because the Warwick location was actually a superior location. It was difficult to get people that had been from coming to us from Johnston and Cranston. I had to allow the relocation of the Pawtucket dealer out to Johnston. And we had always been commanding that marketplace. Well, we still do command that marketplace, even though they now have representation there. But this location has worked out for us. So that brings us up to speed. Hope I didn't bore you with that whole big thing.
So, as an entrepreneur, and a lot of us here are, or maybe listening, are entrepreneurs. We love hearing the highlights, but what's also helpful is to hear like when things go wrong and if things go wrong. So tell us a little bit about the full story. Like you mentioned a few challenges that you had there, but is there anything come to mind that sort of speaks to like, man, this was a really tough spot? Because some of us running businesses are in a tough spot and we need to see the way out of it. So do you have any thoughts on that?
Yep. You know, how you come out of that kind of adversity usually defines you. And then, you know, Grandpa had his problems with the Great Depression and World War II. And Dad, I expressed, he had his problems with his business getting chopped at the knees. We had a smaller version of that, and it all kind of relates around the Great Recession. Soon after I bought the Hyundai store, business was going well, and I got a little bit out in front of my skis. Is that the expression? And I saw some property on Route 2 there that I really liked. It was a Mitsubishi store. It was Ocean Mitsubishi. And I felt I could see that the guy was having some difficulty, so I contacted him. I liked that location because it was right at the entrance of Route 2. So my thought was anybody that's traveling on Route 2 to buy a car is going to come by me. This is where I want to be. So we got that property. We promptly threw Mitsubishi out, and we branded our own used car operation. It was called Tarbox Big Lot. It looked like it was going to be a big success. We had 4 to 6 months where we were selling 150 cars a month and doing a good job. This was before CarMax. We were a used car superstore before CarMax. And the service operation there, because I had a service facility, we separately labeled that. We called that Lorena's service station, and that's my grandmother's name. Business was good, but the first signs of trouble was when the gas prices spiked. I don't know if you guys remember that, but that particular store specialized in sport utilities and large pickup trucks. So that market tanked. I had probably 400 cars in stock, and each one of them devalued by, you know, $3,000-$5,000 sometimes. And on top of that, sales got really slow. So we had several months there where we were not selling a lot of cars, and the ones that we're selling, we're losing a lot of money. So we had several months of losing hundreds of thousands of dollars. And the only way we kind of buoyed that was relocating Hyundai, which was just 2 miles down the road, less than a mile actually down the street, into that facility, because that facility was, we had just recently remodeled it, was a little bit bigger. And then we used the Hyundai store for additional storage space and some service capacity. But unfortunately, that's not the end of the story. That was a big cash flow, and it was a little wake-up call. But it got worse because my banker, who had been with me for years, was with Citizens Bank. Citizens got bought out by Royal Bank of Scotland. I remember he came and visited me and let me know that, hey, listen, Royal Bank of Scotland is uneasy about what's on the horizon, and they really don't like the car business. They want to take a look at their real estate portfolio and make sure that it's balanced. So I was heavily leveraged. It was, you would be able to go out and get an appraisal and finance your property at 80% the value. He let me know that they had decided they wanted to do 70% the value. So I go, okay, so what does that mean? I got this property here, this property here, this property here. It meant hundreds of thousands of dollars at a time when, remember, things were difficult with the big lot. We got over that hurdle. We financed the house and were able to get over that hurdle, but it seemed like a week. It was probably a few months later. He came back to me and said, Ed, we've got some more problems. They've let me know that they're going to let me go, but my last contract with them is to get rid of the entire auto dealer portfolio. What are you even talking about? One thing I learned about the banks is they're there with wheelbarrows full of money when you don't need them, and when you do need them, you know, they're nowhere to be. The vault is closed. So he let me know that he was given the job of getting rid of me, as well as other dealers on the portfolio, and there was no other bank to go to at the time. But him and I had a long discussion, and it was determined that we would basically tell the bank to go pound sand. I had my deal with them had 4 years, a little over 4 years left on it. So as long as I didn't default on the loan, they really couldn't foreclose. So, Dad says, you know, the difference between the way you run business, the way I run business, he said, I used to worry about the money that I owe the bank. You let the bank do the worrying. So, which is I guess I just had that mentality. I knew it was the only way to survive, and I had those 4 years to get to the finish line. Well, again, here comes Forrest Gump. Cash for Clunkers. We all remember that program? Mm-hmm. Okay, Cash for Clunkers was a great concept. It was gonna save the car business. Specifically, it was designed to rescue General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler. Well, typical of how the government does things, General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler doesn't sell economical cars that even match up to the Cash for Clunker programs. But guess what manufacturers do? Toyota and Hyundai. So we studied the program. It was going to be unveiled in 60 days, but they already had given us an indication that what it was going to be about. It was going to be a July and August program. And so in June, we studied it, and I decided to get a full 30 days out ahead of it. So typical of the way Tarbox advertises, we had 200 cash flow clunkers sold in that first 30 days. And that's on top of the regular business that we do, which sounds like that's great. However, if you remember Cash for Clunkers, I would sell you a car, but I would have to have a receivable from the government for $4,000, $4,500 or $3,500, depending on what it was. So this is a cash strap period of time, and I've got 200 cars out there at $4,000 receivable. You do the math, it didn't help my situation. We got to the finish line of that first 30 days at the advent of when the program was actually running, and go to put in the claims into the computer to get paid from the government, and nothing happens. The computer system crashes. It's overwhelmed. So I get the bright idea. What we'll do is we'll have a little breakfast party, 3 o'clock in the morning, get to the store and put in these claims when the system won't be overloaded. So I remember clearly, you always remember these difficult times in your life. I'm standing over the office manager's shoulder. She puts in, you know, the five screens that you had to populate to get to put in the claim, hit send. And you know that death spiral that you see? It seemed like it was there for 20 minutes. It was probably for 3 minutes. And we realized that it wasn't working. The bigger problem was they had a little gauge. They tried to make it look like a gas gauge, trying to be cute. But and it would show the $1 billion that the government used to fund the thing on how much was left. So, yes, you can imagine. It's kind of like the old game of musical chairs when you're kids. When the music ends, are you going to have a chair out from under you? These hundreds of thousands of dollars, or potentially millions of dollars, is it going to get paid? So I called Jim Langevin. I went to high school with Jim Langevin, so I kept those relations. That's another, I've always had relationships. Always remember, what's the expression? The asses you kick on one way, the asses you're kissing on the other direction. So I always had kept a good relationship. I called Jimmy Langevin. He gets back to me, lets me know, hey, Ed, I've got we know we misstepped with this program, but I've got good information for you. They're going to fund it an additional $2 billion. And how much of it has already been spent, Jimmy? Well, we really don't know, but the reason why they're putting more money in is it looked like they've already exhausted the $1 billion. Well, most dealers weren't privileged to this information, and at any rate, even if they, when they did find out about it, they were reluctant to get into the cash for clunkers. So a lot of them either eased their way into it or just refused to do cash for clunkers in the first place. Well, we were in for a penny, in for a pound, so we decided to go full bore in cash for clunkers. We slowly started getting paid. At one point in time, we were owed over $2 million. Again, this is when there was no money to be found. And but when all the smoke cleared and all of it settled, we were the by far the largest cash for clunker dealer in the state of Rhode Island, and it uprighted my operation and got me the cash I needed to find a bank to replace Citizens.
You know, as I look and listen to other podcasts and study people, I try to figure out what they're doing differently. Is there anything that you're doing with goal setting or short-term or long-term goals that like help you succeed or pushes your team? Tell us more about how you do that.
You know, I hate to disappoint anybody, but I've read all the business journals that say that short and long-term goals are what it's about. I'm not that sophisticated. I kind of muddle my way along, and then when I see an opportunity, I'm all in and I invest in the opportunity. But short and long-term goals, a guy named Bobby Indelia introduced us. Yeah. I remember junior year at Bishop Hendrickson, it was an introduction to business class, and Brother Miller went around the room asking each of the guys, hey, listen, I want to know your short-term plan, what you've done up to this point, and what you're going to do at graduation, and then what your 3- and 5-year plan from there is. So like most of the guys in the class, I'm like, are you kidding me? I want to know what's going on this weekend. I don't have a plan that's long. So most of us got up and took our turn and BS'd our way through it. But Bobby Indelia, he's a very successful guy. He knew exactly where he was going. He was going to graduate at the top of the class at Bishop Hendrickson. He was going to attend an Ivy League college. He was going to go to a prestigious law school. And then he was going to become an agent for professional athletes. He's one of these guys that you could say, hey, what's the 58 roster of the New York Yankees? And he'd know who it was. So he was a big a sports fan. It didn't quite work out that way for him. Most of those goals he hit, except being an agent. He ends up buying and selling hotels now. But at the time, there was this movie called Caddyshack. I don't know if you guys remember it. What was the guy that said, Ed. The world needs ditch diggers too. Yeah, so that's when I knew that if I didn't get myself some ambition, I was going to be on the back of the garbage truck for the rest of my life. But as far as to answer the question, no, I'm not that kind of guy that does short and long term goals. And it's worked out for me because I don't force things to happen. When the opportunity's there and I think it's right and I've got the resources to do it, I'm never afraid to go all in.
Okay, interesting. You came through this world of having the grandfather and the dad, and you're cleaning cars and you're doing your thing. How did you learn how to run a business? For me, as a technician or an entrepreneur, I knew how to be an architect, but I didn't really know how to run a company. And I gotta imagine that is the same for a lot of people starting businesses or running businesses, or even in the midst of it. They know how to do the work. They just don't know how to organize people. They don't know how to, you know, kind of run that business. So how did you transition to that? Because it sounded like you've taken the Tarbucks story and sort of transformed it a lot under your watch.
When I first got involved in the business, I didn't even have the advantage you had, which was knowing architect and now trying to figure out how to fit it into a business. I didn't know the first thing about running a business except for observing dad. And he had this small store that in the grand scheme of things wasn't much. I was too dumb to understand what a stupid question is. And I would ask an awful lot of questions, devour trade magazines. And I've also been very fortunate with mentors. I mentioned like Rick Gadoyan. He was an early mentor of mine and a big part of my success. But even before that, and with mentors, I didn't go out and seek them. I mean, if you can get them, they're godsend. But even before that was a guy named Dick Oster. He used to have an old CJ, an old rusty CJ5, and he'd come into my dad's dealership, and I wasn't allowed to take ups or talk to people that had come in the showroom floor, because that was for the professional service, the professional salespeople that my dad had. But I could talk to overflow and service customers. So nobody wanted to talk to Dick Oster. He had holes in his shirt. His hair was all messed up. He drove this rusty old Jeep. We prejudged him, and nobody wanted to talk to him. Well, I, you know, every time he'd come in for service, I'd shoot the breeze with him. He'd drink our terrible coffee in the foam cups. And I think he actually, in retrospect, he probably enjoyed being underestimated. But at any rate, he called me over to this, walked me over to this Jeep Grand Wagoneer Limited. I don't know if you remember those things. It was on the showroom floor. And he says, tell me about this. So I said, they don't sell at all. They get 5 miles to the gallon. Clearly, he was disappointed. He wanted me to give him a sales pitch. So he said, I'll take 12 of them. 11 for my executives and one to keep here at the shop for when theirs are getting service. This is a true story. He was
big sale.
Yeah, he was a light. Well, we became the largest dealer in all of the East Coast of these Grand Wagoneers. They were sale proof. He wanted them. So he would always visit me, even all through my career until he passed away maybe 15 years ago. But all of his executives still purchase their family's cars from me. Matter of fact, one of their executives is a Don Kachiri. He was a young guy, but in the future, he became our governor. So I still sell Don. Matter of fact, I bumped into him at the hardware store, and he still has that Grand Wagoneer, that Jeep Grand Wagoneer. He just has so much affection for his time spent with A.J. Oster and company that he kept that Jeep Wagoneer. When I became a Toyota dealer, I joined a National Automobile Dealers Association. They let you form these sub-group clubs, let's say, of 20 dealers of same make, of similar size, and we meet throughout the country, and they are dealers throughout the country. I met this guy from Pennsylvania who was a real successful dealer, and he got a kick out of me and took me under his wing, and he really helped me and mentored me in the business. So find yourself some mentors and appreciate them.
So I brought my wife to, I think, get a front headlight changed, and she's got a RAV4, which she loves. And I thought, instead of going to our local guy, Ed's my new best friend, so I'm going to go over and see what he's got going over there. And we pulled in, and you drive into the service station, and it looks like an old-time service station with 1950s style decor. This is inside where it's normally dark and gross, and they have caps on, and there's signs everywhere. It's like you're pulling into a museum. And then you let your car go and they drive it off, and then my wife sits down and gets a manicure. There's popcorn popping. There's lip gloss that says Tarbox on it. It's just, you can't believe it. My wife didn't want to leave. I mean, they had the headlight changed, and she's like, no, I'm not done. I got a manicure. And I'm like, who hangs out at a car dealership? So I really realized that there was a difference about the customer, how the customer's treated, how you go like way above and beyond. So tell us more about what is Tarbox doing differently, and maybe tell us about also how your marketing program works. I see you everywhere. I'm wondering, I get embarrassed driving down 95 and seeing five Ed Tarbox heads. I can't imagine what you think when you drive down.
A friend of mine called me the other day. He said, I'm driving down the 95. If I have to see one more angle of your noggin, I'm just going to open the door and fall out onto the highway. We've always been at the top of the charts when it comes to service retention. So the number of vehicles that are in the marketplace that come to us for service. We service, you know, a lot of other dealers' cars, which lead to the next sale. But when we built those facilities, we like the experience, it to be experiential. Think of Bass Pro Shops or the retailer REI. That's what we endeavor to do at the store. So we have on staff nail technicians, so it's complimentary, and a lot of other details. Kind of like Disney, we make sure we pay attention to customer touch points and how we treat customers, because not being in the best geographic location, you need to be able to have a unique selling proposition. As far as our marketing goes, that I'd like to claim that that's some kind of genius, but that happened just naturally, organically as well. When I first became a Toyota dealer, I mentioned that there were 8 other Toyota dealers, and we weren't in the best place, but I had ambition to be the largest Toyota dealer, so you play the cards that you're dealt. We decided that we were going to double the all the metrics of your advertising budget. So it's a per retail unit or a sales to gross, a expense to gross number. We've doubled both of those and spent a lot of money in the marketplace. And I've injected myself into the commercials because there's nobody as passionate about the product as me. So it kind of just it just happened. So I'm glad you mentioned that, you know, you have a new friend in the car business. That's how it works for us. Our unique selling proposition is, you know, Ed's a local guy that is your friend in the car business. So when you're thinking of buying a car, you're thinking of Tarbox. The manufacturer is what we call tier one advertising. They advertise it's time to buy, you know, buy a Toyota. And then we have an association of New England dealers that we pool our money and they advertise it's time to buy during this particular sales event. And then the dealer advertises that you should be buying from Ed Tarbox. Well, in all our advertising, what we try to do is all three. So to me, it bridges the connection so that we're in top of mind awareness. So when you're thinking about a Toyota, you're thinking about a Hyundai, you're thinking of Ed Tarbox. I have a funny little side story. Once Spencer asked me to be in this, I was coming back from Phoenix, I think. I was flying through Washington. It was either Dulles or BWI. And that flight was going to be into Providence. Well, people started recognizing me. This guy comes up to me. And he says, he goes, oh, can I take a selfie with you, right? And this happens more than you might think. But so the guy puts me in a headlock and takes a picture of me. And he goes, you know what I was for Halloween? Yeah, really. So everyone, the people that were standing around were laughing. But the biggest kick I got out of it, Sheldon Whitehouse was sitting there. And nobody was paying attention to him. So that's how we'd started on the marketing. It's worked for us. And again, no genius there. Just seemed to be the obvious thing to do.
I'd like to know more about sort of how you think, how you approach the day. We've got about 10 more minutes, so I want to make sure we hit that time. What's next for you? You've got these two thriving businesses. What are you thinking about? What are you planning? Do you have thoughts beyond this?
It's kind of the same as my short and long term plans. I've got a few things in the hopper right now. But I mentioned that guy Dick Oster. What he said to me was, "It's great. You're lucky in life if you can find something that you're passionate about and you can earn a paycheck working for somebody else, and then." You're, again, twice as lucky if you can go out and succeed in running a business for yourself and taking a paycheck out of your business. But the third step and stage in life is when you have the right people in place and you can continue to earn out of that business, but you don't have to be there every day. You don't have to micromanage it. Mm-hmm. So that's the sweet spot that I find myself in now. You got to be careful with that. There's a lot of people that they either become old folks working in their store, moving inventory around, or they hand it off to somebody else to run because they think they've earned that, and all of a sudden they turn around, they find out that their business has failed. So I think we've been doing it this way for a while now, that I don't have to get in the operation every day. I can look at my reports and I can manage the higher altitude stuff, but I've got a great group of people. So that's how we do things every day.
All right. Well, so empowering your team to grow and take the positions that you were taking.
Great group of people.
Yeah, that's a kind of an exciting next chapter. It's funny you mentioned Bob and Dahlia. So we designed their home, and obviously you guys are close high school buddies, and so they referred you to us, and then we got to design your next home and your wife, and that's just kind of been a sweet spot for us, is that ability for clients and customers to refer us to the next. And so we're really grateful to Bob.
He told me you called him and yelled at him. Said, "Did you send me this guy?"
That's true. I said, "What?
Where's Brian? Brian, you got a different opinion than Spencer?"
I did call Bob when I first met you, and I thought, "Really, Bob? You sent me this guy, and now I've fallen in love with you. So now I'm all in." So that's been great. But yes, I did complain at first to Bob. What did you just give me a bomb? When you wake up in the morning, what are you thinking about when you're dealing with your staff, dealing with your wife, dealing with your family, dealing with, you know, all the things that are pushing and pulling on you? Kind of where do you set your mindset up? How do you get up and going?
You know, I could do it blindfolded now. I've been doing it for so long. Dad's version of the early bird gets the worm was the analogy of what happens to the slowest gazelle? He gets eaten. Don't be the slowest gazelle. So I just I open my eyes, and when you feel like rolling over and ignoring what's going on around you, just hit the ground running. That's always been my philosophy.
So you're up
that's
early?
The way I do it, yes.
Okay. Yeah. What time?
6:30.
6:30, okay. Yeah.
I do my cardio.
Yeah.
Oh, my knees are getting worn out.
Work it out. Tell us about your marriage. I've had the pleasure of working with you and your wife on your home. And so we get to hear about a lot of the things that you guys are doing there. What do you have for us in the marriage world? A lot of us are married. And how do you make that part of your day? What makes a strong marriage? I've seen you and your wife interact, and it's just a pleasure to be around both of you. So I'd love to hear more about that.
Like everything in life, Forrest Gump, I just happened to get very lucky in love as well. Katerina is a Greek immigrant. She came here when she was a teenager, and it's been a great relationship. One big thing that she brought to the table early on that I recognize is she, like most Greek immigrants, are in the pizza business or in the restaurant business. So she had a tremendous work ethic. So me getting up real early in the morning and coming home late at night, she'd give me a sincere hug and kiss and say, "You're home early at 9:30 at night." So that was a big help, having somebody at home that understood what it was going to take to get from there to here. You know, I say that I've been married for over 30 years. 15 years of it, I was a chauvinist, thought that I was in charge. Well, the second 15 years were much better, because I resigned myself to the reality that she's in charge and she runs the show, and she's just a great lady. It doesn't hurt that she's a professional IFBB competitor figure model. And we've traveled all throughout the country while we were raising our kids, and she's very accomplished at that. So if you bump into her, don't say that Ed thinks he's lucky, because it's my little secret. She thinks she's the lucky one.
Well, it's great to see just couples flourishing, especially after 30 years, and just it feels like you guys are like teenagers just met, when you're interacting with you guys. So that's just really cool and an inspiration to me and my marriage. So
thank you
for that. How do you organize your day? We'll close it up. How do you organize your day? You talked about a morning cardio. What are you doing to get commercials and advertising and things at home and all that stuff? When we work with you, every time you show up to a meeting, you've thought about all of it. You've researched stuff. I mean, you're out working everybody. How do you do it?
I really don't have an answer for you on that. I honestly don't. I think you guys are great. You guys bring it to the table. I just give my opinions on it. I don't work too much at the store, so I have plenty of time to find all of Brian's mistakes. Where's Brian? But I've got people like Jared. Jared's my marketing director, and he'll keep me on task. He goes, we've got to redo that billboard. It's getting a little old in the tooth, so he'll give me some ideas. Same thing with the commercials. I've got a general manager that runs both stores that will bounce things off to me on how we want to handle them. So I don't really have an answer for you. It's just the way I'm wired.
Yeah. Well, you definitely have, pardon the pun, but you definitely got a good motor. It seems like you've got a lot going on. And I think it's got to be the way you structure your day. And, a lot of people just don't do something in the morning with getting, physically fit. And that may help you just charge throughout the day.
How about this? I'll give it a lot of thought. And the next time we'll take 3 hours the next time.
Well, how do you stay amped up? Because I watched the videos or the commercials and heard a little bit about you. And then to meet you and realize it's the same person that you betray on the commercials and that you are in real life. You're like that when we're hanging out and doing stuff on your house. Is there any tips for the rest of us to be as animated as
Jared gets that all the time? Matter of fact, he just wrote a commercial that goes in harmony there. I guess a lot of people come in the store and say, where's Ed? Is he really like that in real life? And I don't know any other way to be, so I don't have an answer for you there either, Spencer. Sorry to disappoint you. It's just the way I'm made.
Right. Well, thank you all for coming. Thank you, Ed, for spending the time with us. Hopefully you guys all got something out of this and have something to think about as we're running businesses, as we're running teams, as we're parents and we're fathers and mothers, that there's something that we can gain and learn from each other. So thank you very much.
Hope I didn't disappoint. Thanks for having me.